Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Social Work Radio with me, your host Vince Peart. Once again, we are joined by our co-host Cara. Cara, my friend, how the devil are you? How have things been since you were last aboard the good ship SWR?
I'm really good. I now come from a city of champions, don't you know? Double champions.
Is this Pompey being promoted?
Is Pompey women's and Pompey men's being promoted? Oh, I'll have you know.
Nice.
So, I joked, I think the first time I ever come on here was about coming from, you know, where would you visit in Portsmouth and being Portsmouth Football Club. And, you know, the whole city is very excited, full of Pompey pride, because we are now double champions. The football club that used to have Sir Arthur Conan Doyle as our goalie, the creative Sherlock Holmes, and we're now double champions and being promoted. So very, very proud Pomperian today.
And how are you celebrating this milestone?
Just wearing lots of blue, kicking off in a pub.
Amazing. Wearing your Stone Island, just going on a mad one. I love it. Shaving your head.
That's it. Ready to go wild with a pork pie and, you know, pint of beer and just really embrace that Pompey pride.
I like it. It's city pride. Take pride
indeed,
in the local
indeed.
Team.
Indeed, yeah. It's really nice. It's nice. All the kids gone into school with their Pompey outfit. I don't even call it an outfit, do you? I think that's showing me up for being a terrible football fan. Pompey football kit. And everyone's in a really good mood in the city.
It lifts it, doesn't it? So Portsmouth, I imagine, very much like Newcastle, and the fact that the town is intrinsically tied to the football team. It's a great part of the culture, I imagine, is it? So like, where the team do well, the town does well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I live in hearing distance of Fratton Park, where they play the men's football. And you can hear everyone chanting on a Saturday, on midweek, like you see everyone walking down to the football stadium. It's very much a part of the community around here.
It's very much the same in Newcastle as well. I mean, Newcastle United's ground, St James's Park, where I'm grateful to be a season ticket holder. Unless I'm working or have my children, I'm there for every match. I'm very grateful, particularly given there's a massive waiting list for season tickets now. So I was lucky to get in before it got super popular with the takeover. And yeah, it's huge. You know, I think people who, look, some people, you know, just aren't fans of sports whatsoever. That's absolutely fine. You know, there are many things I'm not a fan of. But I think sometimes people who aren't necessarily fans of sports and aren't tied into that kind of community don't really recognize just how important these things are. You know, many, many people's lives revolve around football. It could be a bad thing, don't get me wrong, Cara. It's particularly a bad thing if you're rocking up with your shaved head and your blue painted face looking to kick off at a pub. Yeah, it's a bad thing. And there is that element to it. But, you know, really, I think sport really galvanizes. It's one of those things that ties people together. We spoke a couple of weeks back about the third place. You know, what brings people together aside from home and work? What's your third place? One of my other places, I think, would be, you know, St. James's Park, the football ground, because it's somewhere I regularly go, meet friends there, you know, speak with the people around me, or go with my friends when we can get tickets together. So what you're saying there, you know, joking about you dressing up and stuff, but it does, you know, the impact of a sports team has a massive galvanizing effect on cities, particularly those cities that maybe don't have the glamour and glitz of larger cities like London and big sort of urban conurbations. It can really bring a town together.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so intrinsically part of the city, like the histories of the city. And when I worked for a children's residential home, we used to always get given free tickets and the kids loved going down there. We would go down there every weekend and they'd have such a good time and, you know, chart away and get really involved in it. So it's such a, like say, an opportunity for community. So yeah, it's good vibes in Portsmouth right now. Good vibes.
I like it. Similar with Newcastle, I was at the football on Saturday. I was at the football myself. Newcastle United beat Sheffield United 5-1. Not so good for Sheffield United, given it was the match that relegated them. But yeah, it was good. But Cara, I'm sorry to spring this on you, but I've got further evidence that my midlife crisis may be gathering pace.
Okay, at rapid speed?
Well, I'm just going to put this out there and see what you think.
Okay.
I went to a nightclub on Saturday night.
Oof.
Yeah, tell me about it. Yeah, oof. That's the noise my knees were making when I was trying to dance. That is, yeah. Yeah, I went to a nightclub. I went to a nightclub.
I thought all the nightclubs, I thought the UK is getting rid of nightclubs. I thought saw that in the news the last week that actually
Not in Newcastle.
not in
No,
Newcastle, still
not in
everyone's still
Newcastle.
out.
Even me. Even
Even
me. So there's a story to it. So best friend's Jason's birthday was a couple of weeks back, but he was in Benidorm. We'd gone out there with a different group of, well, mutual group of friends. But I, as you can imagine, Cara, I may go to a nightclub once. I am not going on a lad's holiday to Benidorm. That is, if that
your
happens,
limit?
Cara, that's my plea for help. I need the intervention. Stop me. When you put like a call out to airports and they stop people boarding on the plane, put out an alert. Just say this man can't board the plane. There's obviously something gone seriously wrong. So anyway, his birthday was out there. So I said, "Oh, when you come back, we'll go out, just the two of us." So went to a gig, went to a local band that we really like called Pensacola Mist. And then after that, she's like, "I really want to go to this nightclub." And I was like, "Oh, do you know what, Cara? I didn't really want to go at first." I was like, I put a couple of barriers in place. I was like, "Right. We'll go and we'll check it out. And we'll see where it is. I need to see where things are first, Cara. Do you know what I mean? I'm the kind of guy that I can't just jump head first into things these days. I have to have a system. I have to have a mooch around. I have to see what I'm setting myself up for, okay? Maybe it's the social worker in me. Maybe it's the fact I've turned 40. I'm just a bit more
Maybe not, yeah.
reticent. You get where I'm coming from?
I do
I like
get
to
where you're coming
know.
from. You like to know what's going on,
I
you
like to
like
know what I'm
your
going to be
routine,
facing.
your plans. Got ya.
And this was 11 o'clock, and I'm usually in bed by 2 hours by that point.
Fascinating.
So I says, "Okay, we'll go. We'll go." Next thing I said, "Well, if we can get parked nearby, because I'm not walking through the middle of town at 11 o'clock at night. I'm not scared, but I'm old. I'm tired. My legs won't handle it." So anyway, we found a car park. It's like, first two challenges have been met. I says, "Right, okay, we'll go to the queue, mate. If there was nobody a similar age to me, I'm not going in." Went in the queue. There was a guy in front of me that was visibly older than me. So Jason says to me, he says, "How old are you, mate?" He was obviously, "Your friend's very bold. I like him. He's like me. He's a go-getter. He's bold. He says what he thinks." This is the guy in front. He says, "How old are you, mate?" And he says, "I'm 39. I was like, "Excellent. I'll have to go in because this guy was 39, but I look young for my age. I don't drink. I don't
Still got
smoke.
it.
I have. I mean, the other day someone said I look 32, and I was like, yeah,
Oh.
that's the best I've actually. No, I've had 30 before. I love it. I love nothing better. So it's a highlight of my day actually when somebody thinks that I'm younger than what I am. Yes. I remember these things. I write them down. I've got a log. I've got a compliments log.
Compliments like the opposite of when you go into Tesco's and they click the clearly over 25 button. It's painful
Yeah,
every
that's
time.
15 years for me. I mean, that's not going to happen.
Painful every time. It's still painful.
As long as people think I'm younger than 40. So this guy was like, "Okay," and I was like, "I've got to go in." And do you know what? I had a rip roaring time. I was only stayed for an hour. That was my
Right.
limit. I was like, so that was my
Midnight.
fourth limit was,
Like
but
Cinderella.
that's what it was like. It was like, right, okay, I'll only go if I can have a look at it first, and if I can park nearby, and if I'm not the oldest, if I'm not visibly the oldest person in there, and I'll only stay for an hour. All those criteria were met. We stayed for an hour, but I'm thinking about going again. But next time, I'm going to plan for it. It's again, this kind of thing. I have to plan for a night out, so I'll have to have a lie-in. I have to try and get a nap beforehand,
Little
and
disco nap.
I'll have to eat at specific times. Basically, I approach a night out now like an athlete would approach getting ready for. I have to enter camp. I'm like a boxer. I'll have to go into camp and prepare myself about 4 weeks in advance to go to a nightclub beyond midnight. That's the kind of level. I'll have to take my supplements. I'll have to have a bath beforehand. Not just to smell nice. I'll have to have Epsom salts in the bath. I'll have to calm myself down. I'll have to go in with my rescue remedy. I'll have to make
Melon
sure in
salt.
advance. I'm just, what you want, mate? What are you taking tonight? Ashwagandha.
He's had his B12 shot the week before.
That's it. Do you want a line? What, of poetry? Yeah. I'll give you a bit of yeats. Honestly, it was. I had a really good time, but I. What next? What next?
I'm with Jason here in that Benidorm was my favourite holiday that I've ever been on. And probably some stories for another time, but
Yeah,
I
not on the
feel like
podcast. Not on the
not on the
podcast.
podcast. But I feel like maybe with enough practice, with enough professional training, you'd be ready one day for a week in Benidorm. Maybe
So
a
hang
weekend. We'll
on,
start you off on a weekend in
we're building up to
Benidorm.
Benidorm now. That's
Yeah,
it.
Benidorm. Yeah, I feel like that's going to be the full, like when we fully embrace your midlife crisis, that's
Wow.
where it's at. Like we'll put a picture online of you just like in Benidorm with a Kiss Me Quick t-shirt, like fully
Wow.
embracing the full
No, that's.
midlife
Yeah, we've gone too
meltdown.
far. We've gone too far. Well, listeners, on this week's let's get back to the social work. On this week's podcast, listeners, we are going to be talking about why you should always take a cup of tea if your client offers one. So every week, listeners, long-term listeners, long-term readers of mysocialworknews.com will be aware that the general theme of the podcast is we take a popular story that's been on the website this week, or we take a key news story that we think might be relevant and it's kind of a la mode of the season, and we will discuss that. Now, our most popular column this week was my column, which was about why you should always take a cup of tea. So on Thursday just gone, I reflected upon a recent assessment session that I was doing with a client, and his mum offered me a cup of tea, and I says, "Oh yes, I'll have a. I don't drink tea. If you haven't got any herbal, I do drink tea, but I drink a herbal tea." I said, "I don't drink traditional tea, but I'd love a glass of water." She brought a glass of water over, and she said to me, "Cara," she said that she'd had social workers coming in her home for years, and I was the first person that had ever taken a drink from her. And I thought, yeah, I thought that was quite touching in and of itself. But then she said, "That's the first time a social worker has ever said yes to a cup of tea. We've had them coming for years. They always say they've just had one." And I wanted the ground to swallow me up, Cara, because that's what I used to say. I used to say to clients that I have just had a cup of tea. I would always decline a cup of tea, partly out of politeness, but partly simply because that's what I'd seen the social workers do that I'd shadowed when I was learning to be a social worker. It just kind of seemed the norm, and other people did it as well. And then I learned the error of my ways about maybe 6, 7 years ago. Other people, I say error of my ways actually, because other people may disagree with me. For me personally, I changed my practice would be a probably kinder thing to say in case other people still decline drinks from clients. I changed my practice because I do reflect upon things, not just my midlife crisis pending camera. I reflect upon my professional practice as well as my
Sure.
personal life falling down around me apparently. And I thought, how do I feel when people come into my home and they don't accept something I offer them? And I always feel a little bit of pang of, it's like a microaggression, not big enough to do anything or not big enough to kind of, outwardly hate people or think really bad of them, but it still hurts a little bit. So I was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to change my ways. And I did a bit of research into it in terms of the gift giving and the symbolism of that and welcome strangers into your home. And I changed my ways, but I never wrote about it. I never kind of shared that discovery. I kind of wanted to at the time, but I'll be honest, I thought that would have come across as horrible and a bit weird. And I wasn't maybe as confident in sharing my views back then when I was first blogging and podcasting as I am now. I used to protect myself a little bit. I'd be afraid to show flaws and weaknesses because I was fearful that people would criticize them or think bad of me, and it wouldn't reflect well upon me. So what I tend to do now is I do share those things because I think, I'm a believer, if you can look back with regret, that shows you've changed as a person. It's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to admit what you've done wrong, because that is the stage of growth. So I wrote the article this week, and many people felt exactly the same way. Equally, there were a significant number of people who also wrote about it saying, "No, I don't accept a cup of tea. It could be poisoned, it could be difficult, it could be hygiene issues, it's not culturally appropriate." So what's your approach? Do you accept a cup of tea if your clients offer you one?
Well, I felt completely red when I read that article. I mean,
I do.
sometimes we message each other nice things about each other, don't we? And that was one of the things I messaged you, be like, wow, like that. Often you read something and you think, wow, I feel completely red there. I feel like you've completely called me out.
Yeah.
I've been found out. I thought I was the only one that said, oh, I've just had one actually. And
No, it's
turns
a
out
thing.
we're all saying it.
Yeah.
And I, when reading that article, I really felt like, oh God, that's really, talk about teaching an old dog new tricks. Like, I'd never really thought about it. I'd never really spent the time reflecting and thinking of it, or understanding that how it may be perceived and why I do or don't accept a drink in situations. And I think you've kind of touched on some of the reasons why. We've got a weird thing about gifts in social work, haven't we? That, kind of kindness is kind of seen as a gift, and potentially it may skew our judgment, or
Yes.
may make us, or may make us think differently about stuff, or people perceive it differently. But I've worked in lots of different roles. Fostering, for example, is one where having a cup of tea with your foster carer was very much a part of my day.
Yes.
It was just very normal part of my working day to pop round, do a supervision, have a cup of tea, have that exchange. And when they came into the office, I would make them a cup of tea. Like, there was a it was a very normative part of our relationship. But then there has been plenty of other situations that I've gone into where I have refused and been polite about it, but kind of thinking about it, understanding the reasons why I would say no in those situations. And it's much more than just, oh, I'm not thirsty.
Yes, and it's hard because you've hit the nail on the head there. There are many reasons we do this. There are many reasons why this becomes a cultural norm within our profession. One is because it's just done. This is what other people do, and it's social learning theory. It's like, we've social learned our own theory that we apply to families. It happens to us too. We are not separate from the same bias and the same theories and the same human drivers that affect our clients. They obviously affect us because, as much as people claim we are not, social workers are humans too. And it can also be that feeling of, oh, well, I want to be friendly, but I don't want to be someone's friend. And you can worry, you can greatly feel. We'll get into talking about this next in terms of, if we've ever accepted food from clients in sort of gifts of that nature, if they can be classed as gifts and had to declare them. But it is difficult. And I used to grapple with the same things. It was easier just to decline and say no and move on. It almost felt, well, if I accept this, that's a burden. But I just started doing it. I just started changing and said, yeah, I'm gonna have one. And it seems simple. Many people might be listening to this and thinking, oh, this is such a trite point to be making, let alone to base a podcast around. But for me, it was the ethos of my practice. That change came about at a similar time when I was able to empathize better with clients, when I was able to move out of the professional sense and kind of let go of my shackles a little bit. Because when I first went into social work, I'll be honest, I was very regimented indeed. I had this drummed into me, this fear of collusion, disguised compliance. And I have to be honest, shamefully, where I was trained and, my practice as a social worker initially started off in a culture that was a bit us versus them. And I shamefully kind of adopted that myself. I came into social work to help people. Of course I did. I didn't never saw a professional divide between client and professional. It was almost always there, but for the grace of God, go I. But something happened kind of at the end of my training and in the first maybe year or two of my profession, and it kind of went the other way a little bit. It didn't come from me. It was the culture that I was in. It was the professionals that were around. It was the dark humor. I didn't quite get it, and I wasn't confident enough to stamp my own personality on my profession because, we've been friends for a while. Carrie, I'm interested in people. I'm keen to engage people. I hate conflict with people. I'm always trying to help and be kind as much as I can. But it was almost like I was adopting a very different persona, a very cold and regimented and professional persona in my social work practice, because it was drummed into me that it's a lot safer to be that way. And that kind of seeped into other areas of my practice, which is, oh, better safe than sorry, err on the side of caution. Do you think that family might be at risk? Rather than having the ability to kind of manage risk and say, no, let's see, it was more knee-jerk. And I think a lot of, can I be kind on myself and say that happens to a lot of young social workers, or was I just very easily led and naive and not strong enough to stand up?
No, I think it does happen to a lot of social workers. And I think, well, the fact that, I mean, I've been practicing for years and reading your articles, the first time I was like, wow, actually, that simple task is really loaded. Like that simple question and that simple answer around a drink is incredibly loaded. And maybe also in an element of culture, British culture, like a cup of tea. When you come into someone's house, you almost always are offered a cup of tea. Like that is very much a part of the culture. And what does it mean when you refuse that? And what does it mean when we are refusing? Because there are definitely times where I've made a judgment call. And like I said, regardless of whether or not it's to do with thirst and the actual question that's being asked, but like you say, you make the judgment based on your principles, your thoughts around the us and them, the collusion, that all the judgments that we all say that we don't have because we're anti-discriminatory, anti-oppressive, and all those really fun words that we've thrown out, when actually on a day-to-day basis as a profession we're probably massively judgmental, because part of our skill set is having to make quick judgments and assessments of situations to then fuel and think about wider assessments. So it's not naive to think that we do learn from others, that we do take those things on, that culturally we learn and we base our practice as we grow and develop. And unless someone calls us out on it, makes us question it, makes us reflect on it, makes us think about the things that just become a part of our daily routine. I go on a visit, do you want a drink now? Or I've just had one, thanks. It's such an irrelevant part of your day that you don't even spend time thinking about it until someone challenges you on it. And then you think, actually, that has become part of my practice that is ingrained in me that I didn't even realize was me making a judgment call about someone within 2 seconds of walking through their front door.
And do you know what? That's what it is. You're right. Until someone challenges you, you don't even see what's wrong with it. You just don't. You don't.
No.
And I didn't. And I challenged myself. I challenged myself, and it's like, God, it's such a small thing, but such a big thing instead. And like I say, it came at the time of a kind of distinct shift in my pattern. And this is the funny thing about social work, A lot of people think, oh, well, I'm a fully trained social worker. As soon as I've done my degree and my master's, as I did, right, you're in, you're fully trained, crack on. That's, oh, well, maybe the SYE. That's maybe a progression. That's maybe 2 or 3 years in. I've got to be honest, I don't think I hit the ground running as a social worker until I was about 7 years in. If I have a look at there were big leaps in my development up until about 2020. I've been a social worker 11 years now. I think up until around 2020, I can look back and think, yeah, a lot of things I regret doing, didn't do quite well, could do a lot better. Since then, my growth's been more slower paced. I do grow as a social worker, but it's been slower paced. But there weren't as many eureka moments. And I'm not sure if supervision in the current training system really checks in with us as well as it should on those softer skills. We're very, very good in social work at checking, is your recording on the system? Is your paperwork up to scratch? Have you been audited? Are you meeting time scales? We're very good at that because that's arbitrary, well, not arbitrary data, but it's objective data. It's clear binary data. Yes or no. Have you done this? What's the quality? There's a degree of subjectivity when it comes to auditing. Some auditors, some managers may have different preferences for case notes and assessment than others. But generally speaking, if you're good in those areas, you'd be good in those areas regardless of where you go, because you can shift your practice depending on what different managers' preferences might be. But when it comes to those soft skills, we are. Once you get to a certain point in the social work, you're not observed that much in your practice at all. You might be observed in meetings, whether that's child protection conferences, looked after reviews. You may be observed when you're in the courtroom if a manager comes along with you. Obviously, when you have legal meetings, you'll have a manager there. And of course, senior managers and managers will see how you go on with them and how you act with others in the office. But in terms of that interpersonal practice with clients, you're not really seen at all once you get about 2 years in, particularly not seen to the point where somebody sits down and offers you feedback on your practice. It's just crack on, do your best, and don't take that cup of tea. What does it mean to decline an offer then? We've spoken about, the importance of having a drink. What does it say to our clients if we don't accept their offer of kindness in their home? What barriers can that put in place?
I was thinking about this when I was reading and we were kind of talking about it, and I was thinking, oh, this is a shameful admittance on my stage where you've grown and developed, but I've just done a fostering assessment not that long ago, and I was thinking, oh, I went to their house and they offered me a cup of tea, and I said the fateful words, "No, I've just had one, thanks."
Just
Nothing
have one.
about, nothing about that particularly that I can think in terms of reflection on that. But after about 5 minutes in or whatever, they're like, "Oh, are you all right if I just get some crisps or I just get some," and they are then asking me permission in their house to eat and drink. And I thought the fact that I declined set the precedent that in this discussion, it wasn't okay for them to relax and to meet their basic needs without asking my permission.
It was on you. You
Yeah,
held
and
the
I thought,
power.
yeah, I did. And I thought, do you know what? If I'd accepted a cup of tea then or a glass of water or whatever, that actually I would have, it's like breaking bread, isn't it? In that sort of
Exactly
real
that,
sense of
exactly
it,
that.
of like because I was thinking, if someone come to my home and then they said, no, I don't want anything, would I feel weird then about having a drink and eating? And I would, because we're not doing that social, it's a social element of
Yeah.
meeting your basic needs. And I hadn't given them permission to do so. And like you say, I'm the person with the power in that room, especially when you're assessing someone to become
Yeah.
foster carers. And are you or are you not able to become a foster carer? And I'd gone into their house and basically refused permission for them to exist in their front room whilst I was there for like the hour and a half,
Yeah.
and except for the fact that they bravely asked me if they were allowed to eat or drink in their own house and permission to do
Wow.
so, and that I didn't. I guess what they might have thought is that I would have presumed it rude or unprofessional and whatever, and that wasn't my intention at all, at any time. And like I said, I don't think I ever even gave any thought around what those words meant, because I'm still using ammonia for, a few weeks ago. But now when I reflect back on it, and that really helpful challenge that you kind of offered within that article, it made me really question and think, yeah, like that is a really strong and powerful position to be in when you refuse or decline something that, like says what and what we keep on saying, is kind of what it seems really insignificant, but what does it mean? And for me, I think it really challenged my view that actually, was I allowing people to become comfortable in the situation, or was I setting a precedent of, in this scenario, we don't eat, we don't drink, we're doing professional stuff. And that was really difficult to kind of accept, that perhaps I'd created a power dynamic that I wasn't even aware of.
And that's the thing, it's a power dynamic that we are not aware of because you do it so naturally, you do it so breezily. And I think the nature of our work, everybody listening to this, I imagine almost everybody listening to this is either involved with social work directly or has a friend or a family member that is. And everyone will know the demands of the job. And when you're so fast paced and you're rushing from one thing to another, it's difficult to sit and reflect on these things. It really, really is. But you spoke there about breaking bread, and the cultural approaches to being offered food are very important. They are very important to adhere to. I mean, there are certain cultures, when I've worked with people from Asian and African cultures, I've had full-on meals when I've gone to family homes. Not that long ago, honestly, my heart melted. I was working with a family, and the first time I went out, they bought me some pakora and samosas and like little Indian dishes, and I was like, "This is amazing." So I ate them, and I ate some of them, and then they made me take the rest away. The next time, they said, "Oh, we've cooked you something that we think might be more suitable to your tastes," and guess what? They bought me out.
Was it fish and chips?
It was a fried breakfast at 2 p.m. I honestly,
Was it to your taste?
well, it was a fried breakfast. Yeah, evidently. But it was just not my heart melted because I thought the effort to do that, the effort to think, but okay, we shared them some food from, their culture and background. And that we're going to prepare this, ever. I'm such a stereotypical white British man. I look like a hobbit. That is the kind of level of whiteness we're talking about here, Cara. I look like a hobbit. I'm hobbit white. That's what I am. Okay? You've met me. That's what I am. I've got a little ginger beard. I am hobbit white is the way I describe myself to people. So, and the fact that that was recognized in terms of, well, what will a man that looks like a hobbit like more than anything, a fry up will get him a fry up. And it was a Again, I ate half of it and I took the rest back in sort of takeaway packages. And it was such an important thing. And look, that's happened to me loads. That's happened to me loads when I've been with families where that is the norm. And you just have to. The first time I did that was, God, it was my second ever job in social work. So we're going back a decade now. The first time I did that was the first time I did have curry goat and plantain. It was with a West African family. And oh my God, it's some of the best food I've ever eaten in my life. But my manager there, she was quite a stickler for rules. And I, good, really, really good. Really good in terms of, very regimented. I learned a lot. I learned a lot in terms of how regimented she was. But it did mean, and I kid you not, that every time I returned from this family's home, I had to fill in like a form to declare that I'd been given a gift. And I was like, well, where's the evidence? It's in my tummy. What have you done with it? It's like the dog. What have you done with your work? I've eaten it. I've eaten the work. But I did it and it was regular. It was put on. And look, that was a case that was relatively straightforward. And regardless, but believe you me, Cara, I certainly wasn't bribed to give the decision due to curry. I was tempted, don't be wrong. The curry goat was excellent. I wasn't.
You're only one man, you know.
Yeah,
You've got no principles.
I just about managed to resist the curry goat and fried plantain. It was that good. I was like, well, no. The assessment was positive anyway. They did great work. That family worked well with me, worked well with the family support worker, really took on board the learning that was being offered in relation to physical chastisement. That can be quite common. I think many people listen to this. You may have come across that, Cara, where people who have recently relocated to England or a different country, listeners may not be, accustomed to the cultural norms and laws of that country. May bring practices in terms of parenting, particularly in terms of punishment and discipline, that were the norm in their countries and communities they've come from, but aren't the norm. So it was one of those cases where it was re-education. It was re-education and support, and it worked out really well. It also worked out well for me in terms of the curry goat and plantain. But I had to declare that every time. But it can mean a lot, can't it? We talk about, this in terms of offering a cup of tea, but when we look at certain, clients that we work with, it can mean a lot more. The offer of food and the offer of drink cannot just be a polite gesture. It can be a richly ingrained cultural norm, and declining that can have significant issues, can it not?
Yeah, for sure. And I was thinking when you were talking, I was thinking one of mine is going up north and going to Yorkshire and being offered fish and chips at a family's house that I was
Nice.
supporting, like a reconnection of family to brother and sister, hadn't seen each other for like 10 years. And I was like, when I was eating this fish and chips, thinking, am I allowed to eat this fish and chips? I can't not eat this fish and chips. And
No, you'd have to
it was
go.
we'd been traveling for like 8 hours or whatever, and it would have been weird if I'd like rocked up with a child, and then they were like, well, we're eating our dinner, we've made you some, and I'd be like, no, I'll just sit in the corner and watch all of you eat your dinner.
Yeah. Can I observe you eating? I'll just get my form out. I'll just get my mushy peas risk assessment.
Just sitting in a weird little social work corner, being like, no, don't feed me. I'm like a gremlin, don't feed me after dark. I think it's so, yeah, it's like really culturally important, like regardless, of lots of, where you are in the country or the world, really, I think. But I think refusing food, obviously, culturally, for in some cultures, is much more offensive. But also,
Yeah, it
it is
is.
just generally weird if everyone's eating and you're just sat there not eating. I don't know, it's just like kind of a weird concept, isn't it? Like, when else would you do that? And then also people have taken the time and been really thoughtful and wanting to be welcoming. And I saw in some of the comments to your article about, again, working with young people and young people making you cakes, and in children's homes watching children make cakes with not too much hygiene regulation in there, and then
No, no.
then being so proud and offering you a fairy cake and thinking, I cannot refuse this fairy cake, I'm gonna have to eat this fairy cake, because if I say no, that's gonna be so unbelievably hurtful. And yeah, I just think it's such an important social norm. And sometimes it's weird how much, as a profession, we're so against embracing that. Like you say, oh, God forbid someone gives you a curry, because obviously that's going to completely sway your assessment. Of course it's not. I get the point of it being, not wanting to be overly friendly and ultimately having to make a decision regardless of the food that's entered your plate. But I think that we put so much emphasis on it
Yeah.
that actually it becomes weird.
It and that's it.
Eat the curry.
Do you know what? It is one of those things where it matters as much as the weight we attribute to it. So if we're going to say that, yeah, you know what? A curry is akin to a £10,000 bribe. Well, okay, yeah, I won't have the curry then. If that's it, if that's, if I'm going to be sold out over a bit of goat, whoa, that's my price. What's your price? Well, Vince, what's your price? Imagine that I'm sat down. How much will you do this for? Well, you're going to lay that goat. Okay. Oh, but some mutton, please, Captain. It's like, what's your price? Name your price. That's it, isn't it? Cara, name your price.
Were prize.
Name
Apparently, it's
your
Mr.
price
Chips.
to, yeah.
I
Could
can't
you?
be bought with houses,
No.
cars, but I can be bought with a great fairy cupcake.
Now, bribes, Bitcoin, gold, silver, ill-gotten gains. No, none of that. But you got any of those fry-ups? You got any more of those fry-ups? I will risk my entire livelihood, my professional reputation, my professional registration for the sake of a bit of curry. But that's the business. I don't know. I just, at times I think we do take ourselves a bit too seriously. And I
Yeah.
think we also end up treating social workers like children who aren't capable of eating a bit of curry, but then going home and not being swayed to, well, do you know what? I've seen this horrific abuse. I've seen neglect. There's parents being negative, but well, I did like that rice. I did like that potato. You know what? That cake was lovely. All right. You can have the kids back, but just give
Yeah.
us a bit more cake.
A bit more care. I think the thing is, and the irony of it is that there's plenty of places in which we do that. Fostering is such a wealth of that. The amount of times I went around foster carer's house and they'd be making me a bacon sandwich, we'd be having a
Yeah.
cappuccino, they'd
Yeah.
come into the office, I'd give them a Marks and Spencer sarnie. There's that element of you're working with someone, but that is completely acceptable in order to, and there's a real clear line of, I'm eating the bacon sandwich, but ultimately, if an allegation's made against you, I still have to follow the processes, and I'm going to stick to the processes. And the bacon sandwich isn't going to influence whether or not I think something untoward has happened within this house. So it's
Exactly that.
absolutely possible for us to do that. Don't get me wrong, you have to keep on realigning your boundaries all the time and being really clear. I'm not your mate, I'm your social worker. But I think, again, like you say, like inf kind of infantile, I can't even think of the words now, Vince, help me out. with making social workers childlike in that sense
Infantilizing
of,
us.
that's the word. Oh my God, my brain. What we aren't mature enough, we aren't
Yeah.
capable enough, we aren't skilled enough in order to accept it on certain circumstances, opportunities, nice things, kindness, whilst also being professional and boundaried and informed and thoughtful in how we communicate with those that we are accepting kindness from. It makes us so de-skilled, but it's quite capable of us being able to do both.
And it's, look, is this just an extension of the risk-averse culture that governs our profession anyway? You can't be trusted to do your own case notes. You can't be trusted to approve your own work. You need to check in and check out and see where you're going to be. I need to go into your diary and micromanage you and put it in there. Is it an extension of that? I don't know. I mean, I just, take the cake, take the tea. If you want it, have it. If you don't want it, fair enough, ask for something else. But come on, is life really, is it really, are we really going to take ourselves that seriously that we're not going to eat the cake? I'm not sure, Cara. But let's have a look at society. Let's have a look at what does this say throughout society as a whole. Now, we've got listeners in over 100 countries. I'm just going to keep it to Europe for now, Cara. So I've been doing a bit of research into the cultural, it's the kind of thing I do when I'm not nightclubbing, when I'm not down the nightclubs. Well, I'm not living it, giving it large as the oldest
You
man in
really are light
nightclubs.
and shade, aren't you? Get a bit of everything from you.
Yeah, I am. If only my mind would find some peace and quiet for once. But no, what can I find? What's next? What's the next thing that can What's the next thing that can feed my ADHD? Anyway, it's not therapy for me at the night. Not this time. Not this time. We've had that on the podcast loads. In Europe, so I'm just going to list the places where you are most likely to be offered something to eat and least likely. You've already seen this map, haven't you, Cara? I sent this
I
over to you. Have you had a look at
have.
it?
Yeah, I've had a little look, and that's why I
Yeah.
was like, actually, the north, you're much more likely to get offered than the south. And I thought, that's right, tight southerners, not
You
giving you
are.
anything for free.
You can say that. There's no way I could say that. I get in trouble for saying that because I'm from the north. You're from the south. So all I'll say is, okay, I agree with. If that's your lived truth, then that's your truth. Okay, that's how I can backhandedly criticize folk from the south. But yeah, it's interesting. The north-south divide exists throughout the entire European continent. So the places where you are almost always likely to receive food as a guest at someone's house are Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece, Turkey, and most of the Balkans countries. The places where you are usually likely to get food include the southern part of France, the north part of Italy, Poland, Hungary, and Eastern Europe. You are almost always usually likely to get food in Scotland, Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and the north of England. You are, however, very unlikely, or no, you are unlikely to be given food in Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Belgium, Northern France, and England from around about York downwards, Leeds downwards. Now, the places where you are very unlikely to be given food are Northern Germany, Denmark, the Netherlands, and the Scandinavian countries of Norway, Sweden, and Finland. So there is a north, there is a
That
not just
north,
a
yeah.
north-south
Gosh.
divide. In England, in the UK, there's a north-south divide in the fact that in southern England you are less likely to be given at the Northern England, Ireland, and Northern Ireland. But in terms of Europe in general, the colder it gets, the further north you go, the less likely you are to be given food. So there we go.
There we go. See, I'm from an Irish Catholic family, so maybe that's why I'm an overfeeder. So, kind of the Irish part of the family is just like, come into our house and let us feed you.
Yeah, that's what I'm like.
But yeah, no, I've do you know what? I do think it's weird when I go around friends' houses and they don't offer you stuff. But again, that's like, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I saw the thing about Sweden before because, see, the YouTuber PewDiePie, he's Swedish, isn't he? And he talked about going around friends' houses and the fact that you'd be around a friend's house and then your friend would go for dinner, and then if you were around your friend, you would just wait for your friend to have their dinner.
Yes, yeah, that's what the Swedes do. That's what the Swedes do. You'll go around a plate at a friend's house, and not only will you not get anything to eat, but the family will all sit down and you'll just be
Sit
sat
down.
twiddling your thumbs watching the family eat. The child is the social worker, essentially. It's the other way around. That's maybe where it
Just
comes
sat in the
from.
corner. That
Yeah.
looks nice.
Yeah. Is that good? Yeah.
So that's because obviously most play dates have like a food element to it,
Of
don't they? And
course.
children's and stuff. But yeah, in definitely, I remember him talking about it and everyone being like, wow, that's so weird. But like culturally, I guess if that's always just the thing, like you don't expect it, then it's not weird. But yeah, it's interesting, like you say, that just those irrelevant things, the whole idea of a cup of tea is just such a small, almost considered irrelevant issue, but actually culturally these things have big meaning and big impact.
It is, and that's it. It's not understanding the ramifications of a simple action and how much offense is caused by that. I'm not saying anyone's done this intentionally. This is a practice that I did for several years before I changed. But I have to be honest, and I have noticed that the shift in doing that has really, it's going to sound, people aren't going to get this. They're going to say that I'm bigging this up and I'm blowing it out of proportion. But genuinely for me, the shift in doing that, because like I said, just last week, the inspiration of my article was working with a young man that I was assessing. He's living with his mum. And his mum offered me a drink. I says, no, I don't drink tea, but I'll have a glass of water. And that led to that conversation. If we've had social workers for years, you're the first one that's ever took one. That was an opening. And I was like, well, okay, what was different about those social workers? What worked? what didn't work, and then I used that to say, can you tell me what they did that you would like me to try and do the same myself, and what they didn't do that you might like me to do? What did they do? What was the difficulties there? And you've got a conversation. Not only does that open you up in terms of bridging a communication gap, because of course I'm walking in this family's home as a stranger, then you've immediately got a basis of, I want to hear your story, tell me your experience. Not only do I want to hear your story and learn from your experience, I want you to tell me what worked, what didn't work, give me feedback, I can be better for you. You end up having that conversation with a client within 5 minutes of meeting them. The rest of that session is going to go far better.
Yeah.
And it's over something so simple, because I think in social work, I always have to have a bloody good reason to say no. Mm. When I go into a family's home, or always, I never go into a family thinking, right, this assessment's going to be negative, I'm looking for reasons to say no. I don't do that. It's always, can I find the strengths? Can I find the safety? Can I find the protective factors to give a positive answer? Can this work? When you have that, you know, that positive mindset and that signs of safety mindset, that restorative practice mindset, and not a deficit and not a risk averse mindset, it can really, really help. Significantly help, not just me, but obviously that's what clients want to see as well. That's what your clients want. And it, for me, something so simple as being able to, yeah, I will have that. You're immediately saying yes. It's an immediate yes. If it's an immediate rejection, we often work with families who have had 20, 30, sometimes 40 years of professional rejection. If you can do a bit different, it can help. Again, I'm not saying it's going to work for everyone. It's certainly not going to be a magic bullet that's going to immediately make everyone excellent, you know, person-centered restorative practitioners. But it's a little change, but for me, it can make a big difference indeed.
Yeah, absolutely.
So take that cup of tea. So, Cara, would you like a cup of tea?
I'd love a cuppa.
Oh, you should have said no, thanks. You should have set you up there. I was setting you up there. That's what I would have done.
A cup of tea for ages.
That would have been the joke that I would have gone. You asked me.
Reroll it.
Let's try it the other way around. Take two. You go for it.
Vince, would you like a cup of tea?
No, thanks. Just had one.
There we go.
Oh,
beautiful.
Ah, there we go. We slow
play. I'm sorry for ruining everything. I'm sorry.
We're back with a bang. Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in. As always, you can head over to mysocialworknews.com, check out the articles that we've discussed, and if you would be so inclined, it would mean a great deal if you could take the time to leave a review of the podcast on iTunes. Long-term listeners will know that when you leave a review, we will read it out on next week's podcast and give you a shout-out. So if you could take a couple of minutes, if you find value in the podcast, please do that. Any feedback, any topics that you've got for discussion, you can find us over at Social Work News or Social Work World on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook. You can also head over to the Facebook page, which is called Facebook group, which is Social Work World. Join that. You can find us on there. Send us a message with any feedback, any suggestions on the podcast. We will be back next week with a cup of tea in hand apiece. Until then, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.